Dialogue, a journal of Mormon thought.
Dialogue.
DialogueJournal.com.
Dialogue.
Dialogue Journal.
Dialogue.
Dialogue.
It's the 50th anniversary of Dialogue.
Welcome. These special Dialogue podcasts were recorded at the Spirit of Dialogue Conference at Utah Valley University on September 30th as part of the 50th anniversary celebration held that day. You can find more information about the conference and the celebration at Dialogue's website, www.dialoguejournal.com. In this session, moderated by Patrick Mason, Benjamin Park, and Blair Van Dyke, discuss Dialogue's role in establishing and furthering Mormon studies.
I'm going to share the title of my paper just because it's not on the program and it's deliberately provocative and should shape the remainder of my address. I titled my remarks, "The Cultural Practice of Mormon Scholarship," or "Why Dialogue Should Not Be Dedicated to Mormon Studies." Now let me explain what I mean. In 1959, then professor of economics at Utah Agricultural College, Leonard Arrington, was invited to contribute to the inaugural issue of a new journal titled Brigham Young University Studies. The publication was meant to be a repository of scholarship written by Mormons and for a Mormon audience. Quote, "The first editors of BYU Studies were anxious to print sound historical essays," Arrington later remembered. "So he was happy to provide work that was based on his recent monograph, Great Basin Kingdom. His article, An Economic Interpretation of the Word of Wisdom, was about as fascinating as a work of economic history could be." He argued that Brigham Young's decision to enforce Mormonism's dietary code, which had hitherto been more of a recommendation, was rooted in a hope to cut down on a market interface between Utah and the rest of the nation, part of the Deseret's attempt to become more self-sufficient. Yet the article caused some backlash. Arrington was told by BYU's then president, Ernest L. Wilkinson, that an apostle was so upset with it that they suspended the journal's publication for a year, and then the journal had to tread lightly over the next few years after that. This was just the dawn of many conflicts that would take place over the following decades as new Mormon history became a sizable academic movement that could no longer be contained. Now, of course, BYU Studies would later gain firm footing and become a strong and consistent producer of Mormon scholarship. But the lessons from this first issue were clear. There were limits to what could be produced through channels attached to an official church body. This was seen as especially troublesome as that we're now a growing cohort of LDS academics who desired an outlet for their work. 5 years later, the Mormon History Association was formed, but that organization had limits as well. It didn't have its own publication, at least not yet. It was explicitly aimed, at least as originally conceived, to a more scholarly academic audience, and its focus was, as the title implied, history. So concurrently, Wes Johnson and Eugene England, who were far away from Provo in the Edenic setting of Stanford, organized Dialogue. Now, the formation and history of the journal is a hallowed tale that will probably be repeated several times today, so I'll skip that here. But what I want to focus on, what is implied in the theme of this talk, is the role of Dialogue in the formation of Mormon studies as an academic discipline. From the outset, I want to explain labels and categories because they are crucial for my argument, and my definitions can be a bit different from others. By Mormon scholarship, I mean analytic research on Mormon topics, most predominantly written by Mormons, or at least people from a Mormon community background, and largely aimed at the Mormon community as an audience. This category could include work that's apologetic, faithful, revisionist, or even antagonistic. But the main characteristics are primarily focus and audience. Mormon studies, on the other hand, I'll define as academic work that may use Mormonism as a case study, but its primary focus is broader academic issues, and the primary audience is a non-Mormon academic community. It most often brackets faith issues, meaning that questions of spiritual importance are secured higher than they would be in Al Gore's lockbox. I had to get one electoral year joke. Now, I use these terms scholarly and academic carefully, as they are not always synonyms. Scholarly implies the type of rigor and analysis discussed in bad examples and in Artis's paper. Academic, on the other hand, uses scholarly rigor, but sometimes to different aims. Whereas Mormon scholarship is fundamentally concerned with Mormon questions, Mormon studies is mostly dedicated with academic issues. For one example I've used in the past, consider the comparison and contrast between monumental work on Mormonism and race by Lester Bush on the one hand and Paul Reeve on the other. Bush's work was to understand Mormonism's evolving race ideas. Reeve's, on the other, was to take those ideas and show what it tells us about American conceptions of racialization in the 19th century. Both are important and powerful works, but each have specific audiences and purposes. Now that my time is nearly halfway done and I've only provided a governing framework, let me explain what I mean when I say that I think it's a good thing that dialogue should not be focused on Mormon studies. It is impossible to provide a general category for the scholarship that has been found in dialogue's first 50 years. The body has just been too diverse and dynamic. But there are key features of its best and most lasting pieces, most especially what have proven to be the most powerful works of scholarship found within dialogue's pages are those that explain crucial issues of Mormon thought and culture by asking questions particularly relevant to the Mormon cultural audience. Think of Lester Bush's article on race, Nadine Hansen's essay on Mormon women and priesthood, Greg Prince's on Ezra Taft-Benson and Mormon conservatism, or more recently Taylor Petrie's work on post-heterosexual Mormon theology. All these articles not only ask important scholarly questions with scholarly rigor, but they either implicitly or explicitly address powerful culture issues. Dialogue then has served as an incubator for the Mormon scholarly consciousness. It provided a venue to experiment with ideas, methodologies, and theories at a time when grappling with them was just as important internally, if not more importantly internally, than externally. Even if we use new models in naturalistic study and scholarly methodologies, these were activities of cultural expression. Mormon scholarship, in this sense, was part pilgrim's progress, part group therapy, and sometimes part exorcism. The function of Mormon scholarship within the hallowed pages of dialogue was a cultural practice that furthered the Mormon community. Once those foundations were built, and once those shoulders are available upon which to stand, Mormon scholars were then able to develop a robust scholarly literature that then looked outward, addressing external questions. The advent of Mormon studies came when academics used the models and materials provided by past generations to speak to a wider academic community. The creation of the first Mormon studies program outside the Mormon cultural region at Claremont in 2007 was fundamentally different in both nature and scope than the initiative started up the Pacific Coast at Stanford 40 years previous. Yet the former would not have been possible without the foundation of the latter. Now, thanks to the foundation laid by dialogue, the subfield of Mormon studies is thriving, though ironically often outside of dialogue's pages. Due to tricky considerations like academic hiring career criteria and tenure portfolios, the best work in the academic world of Mormon studies has often appeared in venues divorced from the Mormon community. Just in the last year, for instance, groundbreaking articles on Mormonism have appeared in Church History, Religion in American Culture, Critical Inquiry, and two articles in Journal of the American Academy of Religion. But, and I want to stress this point, the advancement of Mormon studies should not mean the demise of Mormon scholarship, especially a lower opinion of venues like dialogue, nor does it mean that the one avenue is more important than the other. Far from it. If anything, the production of responsible scholarly work dedicated to the Mormon community has become all the more important because the material of Mormon studies is not always that relevant or applicable to Mormon society. The ivory tower's walls are often quite impenetrable and incoherent. Dialogue's mission is all the more important today than it has ever been because the cultural practice of scholarly thinking has never been in more need than in our quick-paced digital age. More academically minded scholars dedicated to the niche questions of Mormon studies has never and should never make up a majority of the Mormon intellectual community, as seen in the robust work done by people outside of academic positions. These two methodological perspectives, and Mormon scholarship on one hand, Mormon studies on the other, need each other. And so dialogue's mission is only confirmed. Now, just as this paper began near 9 minutes ago with Arrington's contribution to the first issue of BYU Studies, so too will it close with Arrington's contribution to the first issue of Dialogue. Scholarly Studies of Mormonism in the 20th century, the title for an article that gave an overview of the development of the Mormon academic community since the turn of the century. Things had been rocky, Arrington explained, but the future looked bright indeed. He closed the essay by mentioning two exciting developments, quite independent from the church itself, by young Mormon intellectuals for the need for competent professional history and commentary. These two developments were, of course, the founding of the Mormon History Association and Dialogue. While most participants in these endeavors were practicing Mormons, Arrington assured, they, quote, believe that the details of Mormon history and culture can be studied in human and naturalistic terms, indeed must be so studied, and without rejecting the divinity of the church's origin and work. Arrington looked forward to scholarship that would be both secularized and sympathetic. To varying extents, the new Mormon history fulfilled trying to manage both of those approaches at once. Yet, and this is my concluding point, if the Mormon scholarly community has reached a moment where we can split the initiatives of studies and scholarship into two, perhaps we no longer have to be dedicated to satisfying both of those ideals at once, and we can more explicitly devote to the separate causes. Our Mormon studies work, the secular end, is doing fine and proceeding apace. But what about the other arena? Perhaps it's time to desecularize, to push back on the Arrington perspective 50 years ago, to desecularize some forms of our Mormon scholarship. For instance, in the third volume of Dialogue, Richard Bushman penned a mostly forgotten essay titled Faithful History. Yet this essay remains, with very few exceptions, the only serious, sophisticated, and scholarly examination of how history should be done as a Mormon. That is, fully embracing the spiritual vocation of Mormonism's tradition and thinking about what that means concerning scholarly production. Beyond trying to satisfy external observers and naturalistic expectations, what would a Mormon methodology of scholarship look like? That's a minefield that still needs to be dug, and perhaps that could be one of the missions of Dialogue in its next 50 years. Thank you.
The title of my paper is The Bushman Effect, Cautious Acceptance of Critical Scholarship in Seminaries and Universities. Richard L. Bushman published his landmark biography, Rough Stone Rolling, just over 10 years ago. Shortly after publication, a prominent LDS Institute instructor was asked about the book, and his response was jarring. He said, "The next time you go back into the Uinta Mountains, take a copy of Rough Stone Rolling and use it to start your fire." This comment captures institutional tensions between devotional hagiographic approaches to religious education on one hand and the place of critical scholarship and academic study of Mormon history on the other. The former has enjoyed prodigious favor in seminaries and institutes, while the latter has been spurred as anathema the moment critical analysis did not successfully persevere or preserve faith-promoting narratives or failed to portray the church or its leaders in less than highly varnished sheens. Time has vindicated Bushman. Today, rational, transparent, and academically grounded historical narrative is a claimed imperative by many leaders of the church. And it must be said, early and often, that what applies to Bushman's work may be ascribed to Moss, Leonard, Newell and Avery, Quinn, Allen, Walker, Brooks, Esplin, Jesse, Bush, Grieve, and many more. Even so, Bushman does appear to be the historian whose work intersected church education's devotional intentions and academic rigor. Simply, the untamable frontiers of the internet compelled the church's religious educational enterprises to cease and desist, turning a blind eye to scholarly research, findings and publications that lay outside. The purview of Mormonism's highly correlated spheres. Simply put, no credible instructor in the church's vast educational system may reasonably relegate Bushman's work to the flames any longer. The angst of many teachers and administrators in seminaries and institutes was not lost on Bushman. On December 2nd, 2005, within 90 days of the publication of his biography, he noted, "The initial CES have come to represent a certain kind of highly conservative opinion in the church these days. For those who are slightly less staid, the term represents a kind of unbending stiffness which denies the realities. Actually, there must be a variety of opinions among institute teachers, many of whom are not straight-laced, but reservations about Rough Stone Rolling may come to dominate the CES scene. Their negative views will doubtless percolate up through the ranks of the general authorities among those who share the CES preference for a slam dunk. Maybe I will hear repercussions, maybe not. In a way, it does not matter. The book exists and will do its work, whatever happens." Bushman was correct in his early assessment. Appetites for hagiography and primarily affective approaches among teachers and administrators was strong enough to jeopardize Bushman's less varnished and transparent image of Joseph Smith in the minds of thousands of religious educators and, by association, their students. The effect at the time of publication were tectonic, and tremors continue to shake seminaries and institutes to the present. And yet, sands continue to shift. In a mere 10 years, educators in seminaries and institutes have moved from disdain to acknowledgement to cautious integration. Indeed, the book exists and has done considerable work to move transparency and scholarship to the foreground of this very influential educational system. Why did this happen? And the most profitable approach is one word, inoculation. How this word is employed by administrators and teachers in the church's educational system is distinctly different prior to Bushman's work than it was after Rest on Rome was published. Prior to Bushman, church education used inoculation in a way that recommended that CES was like Noah's Ark. Mixing and mingling only tainted the faithful and threatened salvation. Therefore, exclusion was a virtue. The church rose above the chaos of churning floods and provided safety within her pitched lined timbers. Church education may have been just that vessel. President J. Reuben Clark, Jr., in his landmark address, The Chartered Course of Church and Education, presented a similarly strong view of outside influence on Mormonism to professional educators, particularly in the realm of intellectual approaches to teaching religion. He explained, on more than one occasion, our church members have gone to other places for special training in particular lines. They have had the training which was supposedly the last word, the most modern view, the ne plus ultra of up-to-dateness. Then they have brought it back and dosed it upon us without any thought as to whether we needed it or not. Before effort is made to inoculate us with new ideas, experts should kindly consider whether the methods to use to spur community spirit or build religious activities among groups that are decadent and may be dead to these things are quite applicable to us, and whether their effort to impose these upon us is not a rather crude, even gross anachronism. Just under 60 years later, and mere months before the release of Rough Stone Rolling, Boyd K. Packer gave a talk to religious educators. In this talk, he described a group of religious educators in the 1930s that felt the church had slipped from its moorings due to a lack of emphasis on secular disciplines that could reasonably be brought to bear in institute classrooms. Chicago, Princeton, and other universities eventually cost these men their faith and membership in the church. It became essential to inoculate from this sinister intrusion of poisoned faith. It became essential, this was the context of Clark's address to religious educators in 1938. Understandably, Elder Packer's views were shared by the overwhelming majority of administrators and teachers in seminaries and institutes. He merely described the zeitgeist that already existed at the time Bushman published his biography. In the trenches, there were relatively few bumps and bruises in this melee between one's intellect and one's faith. A certain hostility toward the academy persisted while robust devotional and narrative-preserving approaches persevered because toxins came from outside the system, not from within. A mere 10 years later, the church's educational system has moved from disdain to acknowledgement to cautious integration of scholarship into its curriculum. The ubiquity of the internet, ready access to scholarly treatments of the church's history has created moments of serious introspection. As Bushman queried in his published journal, the real question is, should we hide troublesome things from the saints and hope they will never find out? The problem, then, is what happens when they do. They are disillusioned and in danger of mistrusting everything they have been told. We have to get these facts out to be dealt with. Otherwise, we are vulnerable in a vulnerable position. The Institute people, as he terms them in his writings, can work against the book if they choose, challenging the documents or offering explanations. But at least everything is on the table. We are not hiding anymore. In other words, 10 years after the publication of Rough Stone Rolling, the use of the term inoculation has largely been inverted. In addition to President Clark and Elder Packer's warnings, inoculation also means that the church must be protected from poisonous spiritual threats that can only be countered by intellectually guided scholarly research conducted by trained historians. Hence the rise of the Church History Department, the Joseph Smith Papers Project, the Gospel Topics Essays, welcomed and supported historical treatises of the Mountain Meadows Massacre, as well as Race and the Priesthood, to name some examples. Earlier this year, Elder M. Russell Ballard gave marching orders to teachers and administrators in seminaries and institutes. He taught, gone are the days when a student asked an honest question and a teacher responded, don't worry about it. Gone are the days when the student raised a sincere concern and the teacher bore his or her testimony as response intended to avoid this issue. Gone are the days when students were protected from people who attacked the church. In short, learning by faith is no task for a lazy man or woman. This process requires the bending of the whole soul, the calling up of the depths of the human mind, and linking it with God. Then only comes knowledge by faith, Elder Ballard explained. This contemporary emphasis on merging intellectual discovery with devotional instruction in seminaries and institutes did not happen in a vacuum. I conclude that it is connected to Richard L. Bushman and the publication of Rough Stone Rolling. And as such, I call it the Bushman Effect. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Dialogue podcast in honor of our 50th anniversary jubilee. If you enjoy listening, please consider becoming a subscriber to Dialogue by visiting dialoguejournal.com or supporting us with a donation. Thank you.